Halton here. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop advanced safety equipment with performance and protection in perfect balance, like Globe Athletics, the latest innovation in turnout gear. Developed as athletic gear for firefighters, Athletics uses unique stretch fabrics that provide body contoured fit for unprecedented range of motion and flexibility. It's lighter weight, less bulky, and provides the protection you need from your turnout gear. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
Hello, everybody. This is Joe Pernesti, and welcome to another edition of In Their Own Words on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. I want to again, as always, thank Bobby Halton for giving me this wonderful opportunity to share with you a little bit further in the articles that you read in the magazine or see online, and have the authors, as the title says, in their own words, describe what took place at their fires and the lessons learned. And today we're going to talk about a incident, article that occurred in June 2020, Fire Engineering, but it's an incident that is kind of near and dear to my heart, in that it had to do with a Main Street building. And that is something that in my city and all over the country, you know, these buildings are still out there, and they are a type of building that when there is a fire, you need to get ahead of the fire, be ahead of the curve, and outthink the fire. And if they get away from you, you can end up losing an entire block. So they are a thinking person's fire. And today I want to welcome on our show Bill Townsend and Tony Cupsis from the Tampa, Florida Fire Department. Bill, thanks. We'll start off with you. If you would introduce yourself, your bio, and what you do for Tampa Fire, a little bit about Tampa Fire.
Well, my name is Bill Townsend. I've been with Tampa Fire Department for going on 24 years. Worked over across the bay in Pinellas County for 5 years prior to that, so 29 years in the fire service. As Tony mentioned to you prior to the show starting, I am kind of I consider myself the unofficial history person for our department at this time. Very involved with our museum and very interested in older buildings. Was so happy when you reached out to me to do this and started digging into a little bit of your work. And man, you and I are on the same page. I love these old buildings. Love doing walkthroughs. I'm in Old West Tampa right now, is the station I'm at now, on Truck 9. And we have part of West Tampa was one of the original cigar areas of Tampa, Ybor City and West Tampa, as well as downtown. And still today, Ybor City and West Tampa still have approximately 25 cigar factories still standing. And wow, these are your, you know, heavy timber type 3 construction buildings, as well as the old main streets that were in those towns or those parts of the city during their heyday, early 20s, actually like about 1900s to into the 1930s. They were still using these factories quite a bit. So I think it's very important to be familiar with the buildings. Doesn't matter what's in your neighborhood, new construction, old construction, a hybrid construction, it doesn't matter whether it's residential, commercial, or mix. I think it's just, it's so important to our job. It's so important to know these things. I'm not a building contractor. I've had to, you know, learn it on the job. But again, you know, like I said, almost 30 years in the fire service. I'm an instructor. I also teach. We have an organization called Friends of Tampa Firefighters, where we do the instructor classes, inspector classes, company officer classes, things like that. So that's my involvement.
Perfect. Thank you. Chief, tell us a little bit about yourself, Tony Cupsis.
Hey, Joe. Appreciate you having us on the show. I'm a 22-year-plus district chief with Tampa Fire Rescue, a legacy firefighter. My dad was on Chicago Fire Department, which we're originally from, and then he moved to Florida and realized that it would be better to be a firefighter in Florida after a few of his buddies, a few individuals that were close to him ended up having some difficulties in fires and then just the weather alone. But anyhow, I started off my career in Ybor City, like Bill had mentioned. Ybor City is a extremely historic district, which is also our foam station covering the port. And I did 9 years over there as a firefighter, went up the ranks of firefighter, driver engineer, captain, and now district chief. Very fortunate. And I'm now currently the district chief in the District 2, which is our marine division mainly. So that's kind of my forte. So,
man, you got the best job. I think I'm interviewing the guy with the job that I want now.
Well, and that is something that is very coveted on the fire service. That Marine Division going out in boats, it's difficult sometimes to be at work and actually think you're at work.
Pinch yourself. Yeah.
And we just had, as a matter of fact, yesterday we just had a 40-plus foot houseboat that burned down to the waterline. So, and along with a trauma alert patient, it was an explosion. So, but and that's just some of the things that we deal with. We have so much water in Florida that it just we navigate towards that, and that's kind of how my career is pushed me. But outside of that, very fortunate to be a district chief, and Tampa Fire is a great landing pad for me with learning and understanding. And then Tampa in general, the city is just amazing for us. So, but like Bill had mentioned before, with the amount of historic buildings, since it's such an older city, those walkthroughs are just imperative for these crews to get out there and get to see the building construction, because new construction is completely different from, what some 100-year-old buildings, so.
So let's get into let's jump right into the event and the fire. Now, this was this building, you had mentioned it, it's in an older section, built in the 1880s. If you would take us through the call and the first arrivings, company size up, and a little bit about the building itself. Now, we know it's a Main Street older building, but it was in the middle between two, or in the middle of newer construction, correct?
There was some newer construction to the Bravo side. Mainly it was a building that was other buildings were built around. So one of the older buildings in downtown, and then zero lot lines. It caused difficulties with us just because of access, and it became a one-dimensional fire. We had a 12-story high rise on the Bravo side. The Charlie side had a three-story elongated business building in the back, and then on the Delta side it was a three-story, another older built construction building of concern. So and the actual street itself on the Alpha side is the access is just extremely difficult because of overhead power lines for truck apparatus, and then just the difficulties with access trying to get units there. We didn't have a wide view to get other truck companies in that aspect, and that's what we needed, was aerial apparatus to make sure that we were able to have gain roof access and be able to fight the fire from different dimensions. It just became a Alpha side, one dimensional fire.
So this was a restaurant. It was a Chinese restaurant on the first floor. Second floor was it occupied residential or was it storage? Was the restaurant open at the time of the alarm?
The restaurant was open. Matter of fact, we've eaten there, quite a few times. The upstairs, the second floor, was not known to be, and that's some of the things that we have difficulties without doing these walkthroughs. Wasn't known to be an actual, it was supposed to be more of a storage area. It actually housed a few individuals, especially the restaurant owner. So that was something that when we arrived on scene that there was an imminent rescue. They had a paraplegic individual that was actually on the second floor in a wheelchair. So, you know, he was gaining access. There was no elevator in the building, obviously. And he was, you know, getting help up there, I guess, each day. So when truck one handed them off, that was one of our very first rescues. The owner of the restaurant, who also had very limited capabilities with English, you know, caused, we just didn't know if there was anybody else up there. That's where truck one went to perform a primary search, and then, which in turn turned out when the fire, it was way past its incipient stage, progressed and caused an egress issue for them. And that's where you read in the article that they made their way out to the Charlie side onto a wooden balcony. So, and that wooden balcony, you know, eventually became impinged by fire through door access and the windows. That
if you would, what were the conditions when the first company arrived? And for our listeners, we will have some photos and some video available. But the article shows some pretty good photos, so I encourage our listeners to seek out the article itself. But for those that haven't read the article, what were the conditions of the first company's arrival, and what was their size up, and what they go into service with?
Well, engine one was the initial engine that arrived. They were blocks away from, you know, responding. They arrived on scene immediately. There was heavy turbulent black smoke that was coming out of both of the double doors. Obviously called for a working fire, which eventually got upgraded into more of a high rise. The initial alarm came out as the 12-story building that was to the Bravo side. So we were already under a high rise response. Okay. So when we realized it was just a few different parameters, that building, the high rise building, had alarm protection, had, you know, sprinkled. The 2-story building had neither. So that's what allowed the fire to progress and get past that incipient stage. So it was, which, you know, eventually turned into a structural collapse. But that fire condition, turbulent black smoke, they ended up upgrading. And then when I arrived on scene, I upgraded further because we knew we were going to need manpower. It was going to be manpower intensive.
They went in with a 2.5-inch. They went offensive. The fire was on they met the fire on the first floor, correct? So this basically is, we could pretty much assume the fire was on the first floor back towards the Charlie kitchen area?
Yeah, it was the Charlie Delta corner. That's where the kitchen was staged. It seems like it went up through the vent system and then made access to the floor joist on the second floor, which in turn we found out later on that the vent system had been compromised. And through years of cooking Chinese food, which inherently is fried, they had plenty of fuel that was grease that was up in that common area, that space that was there. And that fueled a lot of the fire. And with the eventual collapse, it was difficult to gain access to the seat of the fire. And that was one of our biggest hurdles to overcome.
The when we talk about this building, and you mentioned that it was pinched in, you know, we're dealing with a legacy building surrounded by newer construction. You had mentioned a little bit about the access issues with the street and the wires on the A side. But if you would, kind of go into a little bit for our listeners, what was on the Charlie side? Were they able to access? Was there any kind of roads back there, alleys, service areas? What was the backside like, Chief?
Well, I tell you what, I'll defer this to Captain Townsend. He actually initially started out on the Charlie side for the imminent rescue for truck one on the balcony. He had a better perspective. That was one of the things later post-fire that I was able to wrap my head around. So I'll defer that to Captain Townsend.
Hey, Joe. So, yeah, we immediately, when we arrived on scene, contacted command and asked him if he would like us to ladder the roof, and we'll go check this Charlie site out as best as possible. So the roof that we were on was a building that was approximately 40 feet away from the back wall of the fire building. Okay. On the back side of the fire building, as Chief Cuffs has mentioned, there was a deck, a wooden deck. There was no steps down from that deck. The deck was on the second floor. So there was no, once you went out of that deck, the only way off the deck was back through the building.
Okay.
Below that was air conditioning units. Looked like there might have been a storage building. But because the building we were on, basically there was a closed courtyard. The only way into the courtyard would have been through the building on the first floor and out the back door. You would have gotten into this courtyard. The only way out, same way you came. If you're on that deck, you had to go through the building. If you're in the courtyard, you had to go through the building. So it was just basically a courtyard. And from our vantage point, you know, we could actually watch the conditions change. And when we first arrived, the smoke conditions were moderate. Then they lightened up. And then they got heavy again, and then they got light again, and it was just a continuous change. We were able to keep an eye really on the roof for command. I did my best to try to describe to him what I was looking at, but again, somebody's trying to paint you a picture of something you don't normally see. Most of the buildings that we have in our historic areas, whether it be downtown West Tampa, Ybor City, when we have them, they're just in a row, and there's a parking lot for the most part on the backside. Yeah. Trolley sides are all open. This block is very unique, really, downtown. I can't think of too many other. We have a lot of old buildings on Franklin Street because that was the hub of downtown back, you know, at this time in the early, you know, late 1800s. But this one is unique that the buildings all butt up to each other, and they're, this is the only hole in the ground, basically, if you will. All the other buildings touch each other.
What so was there any, Chief or Cap, was there any thought when you arrived, did this building, I'm assuming this building had a basement, correct?
No, it
did not. Okay.
We don't have too many basements in Tampa because we're basically at sea level.
Okay.
We have them, but they're few and far between.
So you knew there wasn't any issues with, you knew where the fire was at. And like the chief said, you guys went into the CD of the first floor, but how did you wrap your hands around getting into any of the extension or the seat of the fire? Did you know that was the seat of the fire right away? You mentioned the ductwork and the grease. You know, how long into the firefight did you guys realize that we got fire traveling all over this building?
Well, one of the issues in that we're going to talk about as far as learning lesson wise, we didn't really know because the owner that came out, that was one of the victims that we pulled out because he was in there for an extended period of time, had some smoke inhalation. Like I said, was limited in his English capabilities. We got a little bit that it started in the kitchen, and we knew where the kitchen was because we've eaten there before.
Right.
So we've all been there, but we understood where it was in that CD corner. As far as getting to the seat of the fire, because it had passed the incipient stage and we were in a progressed fire, we already had somewhat of a structural collapse with floor joists that were coming down. That actually caused one of the crew firefighters, one of the members, to get struck on top of the helmet by a floor joist. That became one of our casualties, one of our injuries. That was another difficulty. So we had a few issues that started out with the fire. And some of those issues were we kind of knew where the fire was. The heavy smoke conditions, it was a cookie cutter, multifaceted area to get inside. It wasn't just straight access to the kitchen. There was a lot of pathways because of it was a cafeteria style restaurant. So to get back to that kitchen, it was to manipulate hose lines was extremely difficult. And then there was just, with those floor joists coming down, it just added to that. So we had more of an A-frame collapse eventually, which is why we deferred from a offensive to a defensive. But to get to the seat of the fire just never really happened, because the other difficulty was that the building, as it presents, if you look in the pictures, you know, we've got a 50-foot frontage, but it's right. also almost 75 to 100 feet in depth. So to penetrate that far with limited access, with hose lines from the front, made it extremely difficult for crews to get back there. And then when we started having the structural collapse, then it was almost impossible. So
when you started to have those floor, the collapse and those beams coming down, how many crews did you have inside, and did they call a mayday, or how did that, you know, was there any kind of issues once that firefighter was struck? What took place then, and how far into the incident was that when that started to go down?
Well, the actual beams that started coming down happened relatively quickly. I would say we were into that 10, 12 minute mark of being on scene where the crews are trying to make penetration. The individual that got struck in the head, initially was, you know, trying to shake it off, but eventually had some issues, that we ended up transporting to the hospital for. So, luckily he had his helmet on. As far as the collapse, it happened in two different stages. So we had an initial floor joist, and then we had a main beam that came down. The main beam caused the A-frame collapse. That was where we had, you know, we changed our, you know, attack strategy. So we went from an offensive to defensive in right. order to regroup. And that,
how many firefighters did you have in the building at that time, Chief?
At the time we had three operating crews.
Okay.
So with the three operating crews that went to the front, and then we also had crews that were, you know, making access, because the primary search and the secondary search, one of our benchmarks, just wasn't able to be obtained. I mean, we did a limited access for searching just because of the collapse, and then the second floor, obviously, because of the fire impingement with the imminent rescue of truck one, there were just some different things that we ended up getting, you know, making priority. So obviously right. few of our own crew, safety of our own crew becomes a priority. We did understand that there were no longer anyone, you know, there was nobody occupied, you know, being occupancy inside the building. So we didn't make that more of a rescue. It just, we had to back off and then reevaluate where we, you know, where we were going to gain access.
With these buildings and to try to help our listeners and that have these type three, you know, Main Street buildings, the extension into concealed spaces, you know, how obviously that was an issue here, but to try to put it into perspective for our listeners a little bit about, you know, the issue with the ceilings and, you know, the threat or worry of you had mentioned in the article, and for our listeners, from really good lessons and some learnings along with this, is a line of duty death that took place in Boston, Massachusetts, a few years ago. Actually, the anniversary wasn't too long ago of it. This summer, it happened, I think, in July. But the fire occurred in a Chinese restaurant, and the fire up into the void. There was a smoke explosion, or, you know, a violent event that trapped and unfortunately killed these two Boston firefighters. The importance of recognizing and exposing the concealed spaces. Was everybody on the same page that, you know, we got to get in these concealed spaces? You mentioned in the article some of the issues. You're obviously aware, but, you know, the ceilings, how low were they compared to, you know, the original structure? How low were they? Were if you would, kind of describe the ceiling space prior to the fire, what made it up or what was made of and so on.
Well, the initial single floor downstairs, which was the restaurant, it was a drop ceiling. So obviously that drop ceiling, there were some reports we first got there of certain crews that said that the ceiling was coming down. Wasn't considered a collapse because we understood what the construction type was inside.
Sure.
That ceiling, that drop ceiling, once it was compromised, exposed the, you know, the wood floor trusses. And then there was a space in between, obviously, that where the fire, you know, got into. And those small spaces are difficult because we can't get direct water onto the small spaces. And that's, that was some of the issues. And then with the cookie cutter design and construction of those older buildings, because they had small rooms and they're compartmentalized, it's always difficult to get those hose lines and those streams to hit the seat of the fire. And that's what you need. And we were tacking with 2.5. So deuce and a half with commercial structures, obviously, that's something that we're talking, you know, and the fire service is a regular tactic. But even with those hose lines and with the crews that were experienced, because we had individuals on different crews that were and Captain Townsend has, you know, a driver engineer that was riding up that day, Jonathan Pendino, that is extremely versed in construction. He was well aware that we weren't able to make a direct fire attack. So the ceilings were, and the construction was definitely a hindrance for us, but it also added to the fact that it did give us a little more structure, because if it was newer type construction,
we
would have had, most likely we would have had some injuries that, you know, would have been a lot worse, or any structural collapse that would have been, we could have had May Days impossible, you know, the same incidents in Boston. So
did you guys, and Cap, when you were up on the roof, what were the conditions like on the roof? And if you would describe the roof condition, the construction of the roof, was it tar, the membrane? Did you try to cut it?
Well,
what kind of roof operations did you
attempt
to conduct?
The building we were on was across, so we did not have direct access to the roof. Truck one, after we got them off the deck, they went back down, laddered, or, you know, took their aerial truck to get up onto the roof and attempt some ventilation. The one thing to note that we just kind of went by is the roof had a membrane on it. It definitely and it appeared to be very new. Because one of the things I was able to notice over time was it started to wrinkle on the edges, which to me meant it was sagging. Mm-hmm. And that I was able to at least, you know, see and report that to command. And about that point is they took truck one off the roof at that point. There was only one roof access from the interior. There was only one dead load on the roof, and that was a residential sized air conditioner. So there wasn't a lot of weight up there. The access, which when truck one did get that scuttle open, but the problem was it was enclosed all the way down, so it really didn't help. And I think, honestly, like when Chief Cupsis is talking about not being able to hit the seat of the fire, well, once it went to the second floor, that was it, I think, because there was no hitting it at that point. With the membrane, the membrane on that roof kept that so tight, airtight, that I think it was smothering itself out with a little bit of extinguishment down below. And then it would just eventually would get some air and it would build up. And I think that's what changed the smoke conditions on and off. From the front of the building, the second floor windows, which were originally there, had been covered up with siding from the outside. So they weren't, it wasn't really even evident that there was windows there till later on. You couldn't see it at night, which, but, you know, the fire was late in the day, started around 5:30 or so in the afternoon. By evening, you couldn't see, but there was blistered paint where the windows were. So wow. You couldn't put streams through the second floor windows. You couldn't put anything through the back. You couldn't hit the second floor from the first floor. I mean, they did get a hand line to the top of the stairs. But again, I just, because of the, it sounds like it may have been chopped up with storage units or living quarters or whatever. So you had limited hose string penetration up there. Once it reached the second floor, it was going to do its own thing. I just think that that's what added to the difficulty. But like I said, you know, truck one did get on there. They worked on that scuttle, got that open, but with the sides running through the attic, I don't know how far down it would have only gone to the second floor. You know, some smoke release, but not, it didn't do what everybody what kind you of wanted expected it to do. Yeah.
Normal insulation for that roof scuttle was not, when they opened it, it was limited in smoke, and we were still getting plenty of turbulent smoke getting pushed out the front door. So it was bouncing off the ceilings and coming back down with pressure.
So from a command standpoint, I want to kind of move in a little bit about some lessons that you have found as far as what you would like to relay to future ICs to a Main Street fire event. That, you know, what were some of the things that you had mentioned in the article that you guys would go, you know, things would get better and then worse, and, you know, kept going back and forth. These fires are a labor-intensive, all-out fight. Your staffing and the command and control issues, keeping track of everybody, what lessons or what some of the takeaways would you want to share for anybody listening to this as they, you know, when they face their next battle in a 100-year-old-plus building?
Well, I will tell you, I'll start off first of all. It's, you know, they always talk about prep work and then obviously pre-planning. One of the very first things that I realized, because I had gained access early to the Alpha side with my vehicle, I basically pulled up on the sidewalk directly adjacent from the building on the Alpha side. It's extremely visible as the, you know, as incident command. As things progressed and units started coming in, they were staging off to the side because we weren't able to get many vehicles down. But as they're walking by command, I had copious amount of people approach, you know, the command. Mm-hmm. And with that, you start getting an influx of information and ideas that is very overwhelming. So to process that stuff, you almost need a barrier, because some information is pertinent, other information is not. And I needed to focus on the overall plan, and I needed some other buffers to process that information and then bring it to me as it was pertinent to, you know, our overall action plan.
You hit, and I want to stay on that point real quick. That you number one, you stated some things that are so important as far as command and control. Would you, if you were to do it again, would you have set up that close to the incident? If that same exact event happens?
No. And that was one of the biggest learning lessons for me. You know, we talk about, you know, as firemen, we're instant gratification. We truly want to be visual. From a command perspective, running a fire, I'm basing my tactics, my strategies off of the reports that I'm getting from interior crews and exterior crews from smoke conditions and interior conditions. So for me to have vision on the building, I have plenty of eyes and ears. I needed to process information. Like I said, it was pertinent to our strategy. We had a few hiccups going through with, you know, during that strategy, but those are things that are very easy to be, you know, adapted and overcome. But no, I would definitely change the incident command, and I would have been away from the structure, not as accessible, where the crews didn't, you know, pass me by and I wasn't so visible. Sure. I would at least had a barrier. I had two other district chiefs that were there that helped out, along with our administrative staff that showed up, including the fire chief, ops chief, admin chief, plenty of chiefs on scene. So
did you what sectors Two more points on that I want to hit on. One, were you able to set up sectors with those chiefs, and what positions did you set those chiefs up? Because I'm taking that because of the way this building was pinched in, that collapse was going to be inward, and that's what ended up happening anyway. But so where did you put your chiefs, and how was communication, radio communications with those chiefs and the crews and you?
Well, and that brings me to another point as far as a learning lesson. We have multiple frequencies on our 800 megahertz radios. I contemplated splitting a frequency. I had one of the district chiefs with me at command that allowed me to be a scribe and to take on some of that information once I realized it was becoming overwhelming, which was a good barrier to, you know, me pulling back and just getting an overall strategy and continuing on with that. The other chief that was there, he ended up moving more towards the Bravo side and then eventually making his way back around to another assignment, which we had difficulties with SCBA bottles and the amount that we were using on scene because it was such an extended period of time. And we are also splitting crews between the 12-story exposure and the 3-story exposure in order to see what conditions were because fire was still impinging and we needed to make sure that we were not going to catch the exposures. That's became the primary concern. As far as radio communications, there's always difficulties in radio communication, especially when you're in high rise buildings. It's just, you know, the point of contact can never be fast enough. So with that, it's just, yes, we would like the things to be seamless, but with SCBA masks on and individuals not keying up the radio properly, things were broken message. It was, you know, multiple times we had to ask for, you know, to repeat. So, like I said, it's never clear enough. It's never fast enough when you're in. Sure. But outside of that, our operations chief, Mark Bogish, became essential for me. He, with his experience and his time, turned out, ended up taking over the Bravo division, had an excellent idea. And then with autonomy, he went out and created a complete exposure team that got onto the parapet wall of the 12-story building using, I believe it was truck 9. Am I correct, Bill, that you guys moved to the Bravo?
Yes, we used used the standpipe from their building as well as we had moved truck 9 around to that side of the block and used the elevated standpipe. So we had three 2.5-inch lines flowing. Once the collapse happened, we were able to penetrate the roof at that point.
Yeah, but I'll take this, that was the, you know, the quintessential point of exposure because those windows that were running along, it was all glass windows. I mean,
yeah.
At point in time that window was compromised, we were talking about pure fire impingement, smoke load, everything going into that 12-story building. The fire chief looked at me and said, "If anything, please do not catch that high rise on fire." Like, that is what we're going to do. So between Captain Townsend and, you know, designating our operations chief as the Bravo division, that helped immensely. Their ideas and their ingenuity saved that 12-story building, no doubt in my mind. So, you know, it's command is a multifaceted animal. So, you know, you have to rely and have faith and trust in the individuals you work on, and that's imperative.
As we wrap things up, I want to touch on one more important fire ground item. How did you set up your rapid intervention and any issues with that? What'd you set up? You know, how many people, and obviously they didn't have to go into service with those little collapses or that the injury to your one firefighter. But if you would tell our listeners what you had as far as a safety net for your guys and gals.
Sure. Our RIT team, we had a 4-man engine crew that was our rapid intervention team. They were staged off to the Alpha Bravo side hose line. Our RIT pack, everything was in place. They were ready to go, masked up, very ready, at the ready for just in case there was any issues. And we did, we had issues. The imminent rescue that was in the back for truck one, they weren't deployed. There was no mayday, but Captain right. Towns facilitated that. And that worked out extremely well for our benefit. The structural collapse with the more of the head neck injury that we had, that was, those crews got pulled out and there was no mayday initiated. So the RIT team wasn't used, but they were there and they were very accessible in the front of the building off to the side. And what I will tell you that that building, what we realized with the amount of fire impingement, because we had I-beams, steel I-beams inside also that were into the pocketed into the front wall, where after a certain amount of fire impingement, those elongated I-beams,
yeah,
they start extending. And we actually saw separation at the, you know, Alpha Bravo side and at the Alpha Delta side, where the wall had 8 inches of separation. That was post fire, but that very well could have been a structural collapse pushed out because of the elongation of steel.
Did your first company, you know, in these Main Street fires, another good lesson is that you have to, and I guess a good thing to always remember is, you know, you only get one chance to spot your apparatus. And you know, I mean, you're not going to be moving stuff quite, you know, anytime you got to start moving apparatus on a fire ground, it's always become a, at least from what I have experienced, a cluster. So you get one shot, you know, to spot your apparatus. You mentioned the tightness, the narrowness of the street, but how overall, how was the apparatus spotting, and anything you want to add as far as your truck placement for our listeners or any good takeaways with apparatus and spotting of it?
Well, initially, truck one, you know, owned the front of the building, which was, you know, the proper way. It's our tactics. That's why we set it up. They're the ones that made roof access. You know, it worked out. It, in hindsight, it would have been nicer. It would have been good to have another aerial in front of the Alpha side in order for exposures, because truck one was able to maintain, you know, the Charlie and the Delta. And then it would have been nice to actually have another, you know, apparatus there in the front with the full house hookup to take care of the Bravo side, which would have been the 12 story. And you touched on a point that, which was another dynamic to this fire. Like I said, multidimensional, just different things that transpired. At the time we were in the heaviest fire load, when we knew that we were going to have roof collapse and that we were going to lose the building, a hazmat fire at one of our facilities in Tampa was dispatched. So I had the hazmat rescue and a hazmat engine crew on scene that had to deploy because there are hazmat techs. So we had to disconnect from aerial trucks, that engine, and that rescue had to pull out. We had to call other units back in to backfill them so they could respond to the hazmat fire. So to, you know, utilize those apparatus and move those apparatus around, your point is exactly right. It's extremely difficult. And, you know, to get in the timing between, you know, unhooking from an engine, you know, an engine that's a water supply to an aerial, it's lacking in you know, the exposure aspect of it.
And finally, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you guys have you know, eaten in this restaurant, so you'd been in it. But I want to touch on the importance of getting in these buildings and the how often does Tampa now, you know, Tampa's a larger department. And so, you know, many of our listeners are from smaller departments, cover smaller areas. How often does Tampa, are you able to get into these buildings, especially these older buildings? Do you do it quite frequently? And overall, you know, what was your awareness, and not yours personally, but overall the department's awareness of these buildings and their overall attitude on building construction?
Well, Tony, if you don't mind, I'll go on this one. I think we're not in them as often as we should be. Again, a lot of these are, they're closed buildings, unoccupied. or they just have businesses at night. Ybor City is kind of a nightlife strip, if you will, that I guess is cheap. What would you say, 5-6 blocks of older buildings? Might be about closer to 7 blocks, but there's more of them in Ybor City really than anywhere else. And some of them have even recently been converted into residential, as I found out working an overtime shift the other day, where we had a little fire in one. And and again, seeing it from the Charlie side was you know, very eye opening. And talked to the crew I was working with, was not my crew, obviously, but I kind of pointed some things out to them and showed them the importance of getting down into this area, because they're going to be second or third due down there. And just get out of your truck and walk a block and see what's on the back side. You know, this is something that this is my third time in West Tampa. My second time I was captain on the engine, and we used to do that all the time. I'm interested in what's on the back side as well. Because again, that's the one thing, you know, you drive by these buildings, you know, every day you're on duty, but do you ever go look at the back?
Yeah.
What's back there? Because there's fences, there's parking lots. What will the access be easy? Will it be more difficult? I think we could get into them a little bit more. I think Chief Cuffs has did a tremendous job, as well as the crews that were there, because we've had a lot of these Main Street fires through the years, and generally it winds up being an entire block. I shouldn't say that. It's usually at least 2 to 3 buildings.
Sure.
And this whole article got started partly by Bill Gustin, who I'm sure you know Bill, mm-hmm. down at Miami-Dade. Bill came up. He was up here for another reason, but we went to lunch and we started talking. And he was just flabbergasted that we were able to contain it to one building. And not that it's never happened before. It happens in other departments, but bigger departments that have a lot more personnel on scene.
Sure.
So that was Bill's big statement. He goes, you did what New York does, but you did it with 1/4 of the people. You know, so
yeah.
That's, and I wasn't really thinking about it like that. I just thought, you know, I think all the crews there did a good job. The building on the Delta side was another 1890s building, 3-story, and could have easily been a casualty to this building. The Bravo exposure had some cracked windows at the end of the night, and that was it. Some melted blinds on the inside.
You hit on a point that small departments or any size departments, you know, it's okay if, I always say this, that if you have a fire at 3 in the morning and you have the florist shop just rocking and rolling in the middle of this block, okay, it is what it is. But if you lose the shoe store or the dollar store or the mom and pop store 3, 4, 5 doors down,
right,
that starts to come into play with tactics and strategy and overall command. So yeah, I agree with Bill Gustin on that you guys did an amazing job, because it could have turned out a lot worse, and it does turn out a lot worse in many towns. And the importance of understanding, like you mentioned, getting into the backside and looking at these, would you say, either one in chief or Captain Bill, that your firefighters, that, you know, I also find that, you know, many firefighters are used to a room and contents fire and you know, residential bedroom fire. And when we get these, it's a challenge, because day in and day out, we're going to, you know, kitchen and bedroom fires.
Yes.
Is that the same in Tampa?
Oh yeah, I would. There's a chief that we work with that, you know, he refers to it as flipping the switch.
Yeah.
You know, mentally you need to have it in your mind that should I pull up on something commercial or something like this, you know, to flip that switch into that large caliber of hose string as my attack. You know, go out and train with it. Don't be intimidated by it. Know that this is what, you know, at times this is going to be the tool that you have to use. And yeah. Yes, I think it on a, I think we've definitely improved on that. You know, I'll go back years and years ago where, you know, I mean, we still had the old 1-inch red lines on the trucks, the engines when I came on, and people were still pulling those, even though it was sure. an NFPA no-no. But my goodness, how hard is 1¾-inch that you're going with this red line instead? So it was yeah. almost like that's the mentality of going from 1¾-inch to 2½ is you better have some manpower on it, which is fine. You know, just realize that. It's not a 1 or 2 person operation. Let's get some people on it, and I think you'll have good results. But yeah, it is, you know, that's the majority of what we do is the residential. So I think that, you know, it's a mindset that you've just got to be ready for when it comes.
Yep, absolutely. Chief, any thoughts on that?
Well, like Bill touched on, it's just these are low frequency fires. So yeah. flipping that switch, it's imperative, you know, having those initial crews on scene and having, you know, the downtown station be aware of high rises and what they encounter, you know, those dropping those 2½s on the ground and making sure you got some solid bore nozzles out there to make penetration. I mean, those are key items. And then getting crews in to do a rapid search to try to find any victims, because knowing the construction, all things from veteran firefighters that train, and you know, the master station downtown is extremely good. Bill was a captain and driver downtown, brought crews, you know, through a lot of those buildings there to see what you encounter. And I've been walkthroughs with Captain Townsend, learned a lot from those, because that's the time you want to be able to look into those structures and notice that when you walk down the hallway, there are several different cubicle rooms that are there either for storage or for living occupancy. So knowing that, you know, to get lost or, you know, to have some type of mayday situation, those are very high percentages of possibilities. And that's why, you know, Captain Townsend's, you know, his goal is to bring awareness, and we see that on the job. That's becoming a lost art.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You're absolutely right. And the other thing that every new firefighter, well, you know, or every firefighter now has is in their pocket, that when they go to these buildings, you take some pictures and you start building yeah. a library. And it's so easy now compared to when the three of us came on the respective jobs, that, you know, that it is so different. And so anybody listening to this that is just coming into the fire service, or you know, or anybody in the fire service for that matter, but younger members, when you go into these buildings, you know, listen to what these two gentlemen are saying, that, you know, that to get into these buildings, to take pictures, to look at all these little cubicles and be able to flip that switch, because it is difficult to flip that switch if you're not totally into it and understanding of the building. Gentlemen, I want to thank you. Any last lessons or anything that we haven't touched on that you would want to share about this fire or about anything in general with these types of buildings? Chief? Well,
the one aspect we failed to mention in this podcast was utilities. Which in downtown Tampa, the structural collapse prevented us to get to the panel, the main panel. TECO, Tampa Electric Company, had to shut it off in a vault. So they had to send out a special crew. So we were operating with live electrical. And then the gas meter was nowhere to be found. So we had live gas in the building along with fire impingement, which probably added to that, obviously. And when after the fire we went through, TECO Gas came out and they went to look for the meter to the point where they had to shut off the entire block because they could not find it. The meter was wow. in a build out portion of the restaurant behind an old shutter.
And that's where we talk about knowing your buildings and doing the walkthroughs, speaking with the owners and saying, hey, where's your power panel? Where's your gas meter? Where is, you know, these are things in these pre-plans that would have been imperative And it, the last pre-plan that we had, and you can correct me, Bill, if I'm wrong, was done by Captain Carl Wolf. It was, I think, 8 or 9 years prior. So we had, there were build outs and additions to this building that we were not aware of. So that was a big hindrance for us to operate within, you know, normally we cut the power to the facility, obviously, for, you know, no electrocution. And then gas is obviously a huge hazmat for us. But, you know, those were, that was one of the main difficulties. But just bringing it back to Captain Townsend, as far as his, you know, goal of bringing awareness and getting out there, doing those pre-plans and getting crews walking through, knowing your structures and your territory, that would have been really pertinent information at that point in time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I agree. And Chief Joe, you know, again, I'll beat on walkthroughs just because I value their importance.
Absolutely.
Being assigned to a truck company now has given me great vantage point to, like, we'll do it generally on a Saturday or Sunday when traffic's not as bad. And we'll go, we recently did it, right across the river from downtown is a strip of historic buildings across from the University of Tampa, which include a fairly, at the time it was a large theater. I mean, it's probably not considered large nowadays. But every building on this whole entire block is probably around 100 years old. So we went and set our ladder truck up on the back side of the businesses face each direction because it's on a pie-shaped lot. And so we went and set up, and because my concern was, what are these roofs? What's the condition of these roofs of these businesses? There's a restaurant, several restaurants, the theater, and some other business offices. And surprisingly, I'm going to guess that whoever owns the entire block, whoever the owner is, other than maybe the theater, because I think that's owned by the university. But everybody had a brand new roof, brand new AC system. The restaurant looked like it had a brand new ventilation system. So that's, you know, relieving to know that, okay, if I've got to get up on this roof, I'm probably going to be okay, at least if it's something early on. And again, because of the layout of this block, there's no Charlie side. But we've done that in West Tampa. We have an actual main street in West Tampa. And there's a handful of buildings still remaining. But we've done it for the cigar factories. We've gone and set up to, you know, get a look at their roof. If we can contact an owner, we've done the walkthroughs. They have quasi basements, if you will, where they store the tobacco leaves. They called it a basement, but it's really only a few feet below ground. I guess technically it's still a basement. But we've also gotten up on their roofs, learned something interesting with these cigar factories. If they have a clock tower, there is a steel water tank inside that clock tower. That's how they built the clock towers, to hide the water tanks because they were considered unsightly. Wow. So again, in a collapse situation, that's going to take out a lot of people and apparatus potentially. So it's good to know that there's a big steel tank inside that clock tower. But, and again, like I said, I just love the history of it. It's interesting to see how things used to be made. I'm very interested in new construction as well to see the changes, but I can't harp on it enough, the importance of just going out and seeing buildings and seeing how they've changed. And, also just knowing where things are, like the gas shutoffs, key locations. Do they have 24-hour security? What else do they have? You know, where are their elevators located? What type of key operates their elevator? These are all things that aren't just important to me as an officer, but the firefighter needs to know it. And this I hope, if there are any listeners that are new in their career, that when they go do a walkthrough, it's not for the officer, it's for everyone.
Amen.
As Chief Cups just mentioned, yeah, I spent 3 years downtown and I still know those buildings, many of those buildings, the high rises, because the captain I had at the time, we did walkthroughs all the time. We did them on our days off. We were that geeky, I guess. But I wanted to know where a handful of things were. And if I've got somebody filling that position for the day, and this is something I'm sure Chief Cupsis will touch on, if you've got somebody filling that seat for the day that's from another neighborhood, another station, doesn't know the territory, doesn't know the buildings, doesn't know anything. But that firefighter paid attention at a walkthrough. He's my hero today.
Yeah.
Because I don't know where the keys are. I don't know where the Knox box is. I might not know where the elevators are, which ones go to which floor. And if this guy's paid attention, he's going to go, hey, Cap, the keys are over here. The elevator's over here. The standpipe's over here. FDC's over here. I mean, that guy, if he's paid attention, he's my hero. So that's why, to me, and I always stress it when we do walkthroughs, because the firefighters tend to hang in the back and look at their phones and chat with each other and catch up on their day or their week and what are they doing on their days off. They think the walkthrough is for me, which it is, but I've walked through some buildings more than once.
Right.
And I want them to understand that, you know, this is for them when I'm not here.
Well,
you know,
well put. So, well, that is an excellent point that we'll end it with that, you know, get in your buildings and they're for everybody. And if you're a younger firefighter, yes, your officer's leading the way in taking the notes and so on, but you can take your own notes and that's what makes you a better firefighter. Gentlemen, I want to thank you. It's a very good lessons learned. Once again, it's the article we're talking about tonight is Response to a Fire in a 100-year-old Taxpayer in Tampa, Florida. It was in the June 2020 Fire Engineering in the Fire Focus section. And Captain William Townsend and Chief Tony Cupsis, thank you. If someone wants to get in touch with either one of you, would they be able to? And what's the best way to get in touch with you if they had further questions on this? Anyone?
Probably the best way is our city email, would you imagine, Bill?
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. So mine is bill.townsend, T-O-W-N-S-E-N-D, at tampagov.net.
Okay.
Hopefully that's simple enough.
Mine's going to be anthony.cupsis, and that's K-U-P-S-I-S, at tampagov.net. Those are our city emails, and we'll take any correspondence or any questions. And if, you know, we need any pictures or follow-up on that, we did an extensive after action as far as going through and looking at the building, you know, post fire, which was extremely intuitive. So
perfect. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I appreciate having you on.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate the opportunity.